Let's turn to the book of Job, chapter 32, as we have a new character introduced to us in the book of Job, who takes a different line of argument than the three friends that had come to comfort Job. The book of Job is an interesting book. It is one of the oldest books of literature, and it examines one of the oldest problems of man. And that is, why do good people often suffer, and ungodly people often prosper? Job was as good as they come. God testified of Job that he was a good man, a perfect man who loved good and hated evil. Satan challenged God concerning Job, declaring that Job was only a mercenary. He only served God for personal profit and benefit, that God had blessed Job so much that anybody would serve God with those kind of blessings. For Job was a very wealthy man and considered one of the great men of the East. So God allowed Satan to strip him of his wealth, at which point Job knelt down and said, "Naked I came into the world, naked I'm going out, the Lord has given, the Lord has taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord." And in all of these things, he did not curse God nor charge God foolishly. And so Satan then said, "Skin for skin. A man will give everything he has for his life. You haven't let me touch him physically. Let me physically afflict him and he will curse you to your face." So God gave to Satan the open door to afflict Job physically, and Job lost his health, became a miserable, loathsome creature. At this point, his wife, in seeing him suffer, said, "Job, why don't you just curse God and die? Get it over with." His three friends came to comfort him, but rather than comforting him, they sought to understand his dilemma, and they could only come up with the solution that somehow Job was guilty of some heinous sin, and what he was experiencing was the judgment of God for his sin. Job maintained the fact that he was innocent of the charges that they were making against him, that he was not hiding some horrible sin in the closet someplace, that he wasn't a hypocrite, that he was sincere before God. And this only angered Job's friends. They began to turn against him, and it turned into quite a vitriolic type of charges and countercharges between Job and his friends. Finally, Job made his last and longest appeal, and he declared in the end of verse chapter 31, "The words of Job are ended." You know, I've said all I can say on this subject. I'm innocent from the charges you guys have made. I maintain that I am innocent. I maintain that I have been honest. I maintain my integrity, and I will not capitulate to your charges of hypocrisy or some horrible evil. So we read chapter 32 that these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. They could not convince him that God was judging him for some horrible evil. So there was a young man that was sitting listening to this whole series of arguments. This young man's name was Elihu. These friends of Job were no doubt older men. In fact, he speaks of their age. And so was kindled the wrath of Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzite. Now, back in Genesis 22, you'll find that the brother of Abraham, whose name was Nahor, had probably twin sons that he called Huzz and Buzz. You know, you like twins, their names to rhyme sometimes, Larry and Jerry and all. So he called them Huzz and Buzz. And from Buzz, the son of Nahor, who was the nephew to Abraham, came a tribal group of people called the Buzzites. And so this fellow, Elihu, was from this descendant of the nephew of Abraham. And that will give to you really sort of a timing for the book of Job. The book of Job historically goes way back, close to the time of Abraham. This story of Job from a historic standpoint took place. Of the family of Ram, and you will find that this is Aram, who was the nephew of Buzz in Genesis 22. And this young fellow was stirred up. He'd been listening to these older men, and he'd been listening to the accusations made against Job and Job's protesting of his innocence. And now, finally, when Job has made his final speech and they haven't been able to put Job down or to silence him, he gets angry. The guys have nothing more to say, and his wrath is kindled against Job. And he said, because Job justified himself rather than God. Job was questioning why God allowed all of these things to happen, and did intimate that God was not dealing fairly with him. Because of all of these calamities, and he really didn't know why the calamities, for he said, I am innocent. And so in a sense, this is correct that Job was justifying himself rather than seeking to justify God. He was also angry at Job's three friends because they had not found any answer, and yet they condemned Job. They were condemning a man for whom they could not really make any positive charges. All of the charges they were making against Job were supposed charges. They had not really brought any evidence of any real guilt. Now, Elihu had waited until Job had spoken because they were older than he. And when he saw that there was no answer in the mouth of these three men, then his anger was kindled. And Elihu, the son of Barachel, the Buzzite, answered and said, I am young and you are very old. Now at that point, they should have put him down. You know, you don't mind being called old, but you don't like to be called very old. I will admit to being old, but I will not admit to being very old. But it's amazing when you are a young person, how old 60 years seems to be. Job was about 70 years old when this whole thing was taking place. So, I am young, you are very old. Wherefore, I was afraid and dared not to venture my opinion. You fellows are old, you're supposed to be wise, and I'm just a young man. And so I didn't want to give my opinion. I said to myself, days should speak. That is, men of years, men of experience. And the multitude of years should teach wisdom. But there is a spirit in men, and the inspiration of the Almighty that gives them understanding. So that when God speaks to a person, ages of no account, God can speak to a young person as well as to an old person. Inspiration can come to the young as well as the old. And so he is, in a sense, intimating that his declarations are going to be inspired by God, and that inspiration doesn't know age. It is true that God can speak to young people as well as speak to older people. The Bible tells us that in the last days, God would pour his spirit upon all flesh, and your sons and daughters will prophesy. Your young men shall see visions. Your old men shall dream dreams. And so it speaks about God in the latter days speaking through young people. And so Elihu here declares that there is the inspiration of the Almighty, and it is no respect of age. Great men are not always wise. And that's a very astute and remarkable statement, and surely I have found that to be so. Great men are not always wise. The psalmist said, "The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God." There are many men today considered great men who have taken the position of an atheist. They have declared, "There is no God." They are not wise. The Bible calls them fools. Neither do the aged always understand judgment. Therefore I said, "Hearken to me, and I will give to you my opinion." I ventured to offer now my own opinion on this matter. "Behold, I waited for your words. I listened to your reasons while you were searching out what to say. Yes, I attended unto you, and behold, there was none of you that convinced Job, or that gave an adequate answer to his words. Lest you should say, 'We have found out wisdom, and God has thrust him down, not man.'" Now, he has not directed his words against me, and neither will I answer him with your speeches. Job had answered his friends. He had called them windbags and counselors of no value, and he had called them a lot of names. He said, "He hasn't called me any names." And I'm going to give a new opinion on the subject. And truly, he does offer a whole new slant. Basically, these friends of Job had taken the position that the suffering of Job had come as the judgment of God against his sin. And this is the position that people often take when a person is suffering personal calamity. It is not a correct position, always. It may be, but it is wrong to always assume that personal calamity is a judgment of God for a person's wrongdoing. We were pastoring in our early years, when we were young, in Tucson, Arizona. And we had a man in our church one night make a request for prayer for his wife, who had had the flu for a couple of weeks. And in requesting prayer for her, He said, would you please pray that my wife will confess whatever sin she's guilty of so she can get over the flu? She's been sick too long. If I were her, I would have killed him. But it is the opinion that many times people take, that if a person is sick, it's because of some sin in their lives. This is the general tact of the friends of Job. This was their conclusion of the matter. No one could suffer as Job suffered except it be a punishment from God, a judgment of God because of the man's sin. Elihu is offering now a different suggestion for this. He is suggesting that God does not always punish a person in judgment, but that often God uses calamity as a reproof to turn man back in the right path. That when a child of God is going astray, that often God will bring things into their lives that will stop them on that path and cause them to turn from the path of destruction. That the judgments of God are corrective rather than punitive. And this is closer to the truth. The Bible tells us that whom the Lord loveth, he chasteneth. And that we're not to despise the chastening of the Lord. And it is true that when we begin to walk a path that is opposed to the ways of God, that God will sometimes allow calamity to come to turn us back onto the right path. Oftentimes, God uses pain or suffering in our lives in a corrective way to turn us back to Him. And thus is the argument that Elihu will follow. So he said he would offer his opinion. So I will not answer him with your speeches. I'm not going to take the same tact that you did. They were amazed, he is saying, concerning Job's friends. They answered no more. They left off speaking. And when I waited, he waited for them to answer. Come on, you know, get him again. And so I waited, but they spake not. They stood still. They answered no more. And so I said, I will answer also my part and show you my opinion. For I am filled with this matter. The spirit within me is constraining me. Paul the Apostle spoke about the love of Christ constrained him. He had to speak. This fellow felt so full of this whole matter with Job, he felt forced to offer his opinion. He said, behold, my belly is as wine which has no vent. It's ready to burst like new bottles. Now, when the wine is in the process of fermenting, it gives off a gas. And when they would pour the wine into these bottles, which were actually leather skins, and if it was still in the process of fermenting, it would give off this gas, and these skins would stretch with this gas. The pressure would build up inside, and if the skins were old, they would break the leather. They would just pop, and the wine would go everywhere. That's what Jesus said. You don't put new wine into old skins because the gases let off will just create the pressure and they'll finally pop. And they even often pop new skins, new bottles. So he's saying, I'm like, my belly is like wine that's been poured into a skin that has no vent. And the pressure is building up. I'm going to burst if I don't say something. You ever feel that way? I will speak that I may be refreshed or relieved from this tremendous pressure within. I will open my lips and answer. Let me not, I pray you, accept any man's person. Now, you fellows are older than I. But I don't want to be a respecter of persons. Neither let me give flattering titles unto man. For I know not to give flattering titles. In so doing, my Maker would soon take me away. David spoke against flattering titles, as did Solomon in the book of Proverbs. Flattering titles is something that I can't really abide. I grew up in a denomination where they loved to give flattering titles. Well, I could say a lot, but I won't. It's just... So he said, now listen, Job, I pray thee, hear my speeches and hearken to all my words. You see, he hasn't really said anything yet. He's just telling about what he's going to say and why he's going to say it. He waits a while to get to what he's going to say. So listen to me, hearken to my words. Behold, I have opened my mouth and my tongue hath spoken in my mouth. My words shall be of the uprightness of my heart. My lips shall utter knowledge clearly. The Spirit of God hath made me, and the breath of the Almighty hath given me life. So he is saying, now look, listen to me, hearken to me. I'm going to speak from the uprightness of my heart. I'm going to explain things clearly to you. The Spirit of God has made me. The breath of the Almighty has given me life. And if you can answer me, set your words before me. Stand up. If you have an argument with me, go ahead and challenge what I say. Behold, I am according to thy wish in God's stead, but I also am formed out of the clay. Now, this guy's pretty stuck on himself in a way. Earlier, Job had said that he wished there was someone that could stand between him and God. He could not appeal his case directly to God. God is so great, the consciousness of the greatness of God. And what is man that he can justify himself before God? And there is no daysman between us who can lay his hand upon us both. And so Job was wishing for someone that could stand in God's stead so he could plead his case. He said, hey, I'm your man. I am what you were wishing for. I will stand there in God's stead. And yet, I was made out of the clay. I'm just in a body also. I am of the dust of the earth as you are. So I can relate to you, but I will stand in God's stead. Behold, my terror shall not make you afraid. Now, Job said he was terrified of God. He didn't understand God, and therefore he was terrified of God. He says, look, Job, you don't have to be terrified of me. I will be here as God's counterpart, and my terror shall not make you afraid. Neither shall my hand be heavy upon you. And Job had complained about the heavy hand of God upon his life. Behold, he said, surely you have spoken in my hearing. I heard you say this, Job. But he does not quote Job exactly. He misquotes Job, or he takes inferences from what Job said and declares them as Job's words. Though Job, he's not really quoting in a verbatim way. I have heard the voice of your words. I've heard you say this, Job. I've heard you say that I am clean without transgression. I am innocent. Job really didn't say that. Job confessed that he had sinned. Neither is there iniquity in me. Now, Job was saying, I've not done anything to deserve all that I am experiencing. You've said, behold, God finds occasions against me, and he counts me as his enemy. Job did say words to that effect. He puts my feet in the stocks, and he marks all my paths. Behold, in this you are not just. You've been making statements that are wrong, that you are innocent, and that God has put your feet in the stocks. And he's found occasions against you, and he counts, look, that is not right. I will answer thee that God is greater than man. And why do you strive against him? For he giveth not account of any of his matters. Job, God doesn't owe you any answers. God doesn't have to give you an accounting of his ways. This is very true. Paul the Apostle, in talking of the sovereignty of God over man, and using the figure of God as a potter and man as the clay that is formed by the potter, that the clay has no power over its destiny. The clay is in the hand of the potter, and the potter has the power to make of that clay anything he wants. He can make a spittoon, or he can make a vessel to carry water, or a vessel to hold food, or a vessel to hold flowers. And that God has the sovereign power over man to make of me whatever he wants, a vessel of honor or a vessel of dishonor, and that the clay has no right to say to the potter, hey, why did you make me like this? Why did you make me a dumpy looking thing? Why didn't you make me long and slim and beautiful? Why did you make me so tall? Why didn't you make me taller? The clay has no rights to challenge the potter. And so this is the direction that Elihu is coming from with Job, that God is greater than man. And why do you strive against God? Because he doesn't have to give an account of any of his matters. For God speaks once, yea, twice, yet man does not perceive it. God often speaks to us in the situations of life, but we don't see it. We don't perceive it. And there are often times when God is dealing with a person and the person isn't even aware of it. Calamity begins to come in their lives, but they just aren't aware that God is seeking to get their attention or seeking to deal with them. So he speaks once, he speaks twice. And yet a person doesn't perceive that God is seeking to speak to him. He speaks to man in a dream or in a vision. A vision of the night when deep sleep falleth upon man in the slumberings upon the bed. This is the subject we'll be taking up on Thursday night as we deal how God speaks with man. Speaking to man through dreams, through visions, the various ways that God speaks. And he is telling of some of the ways that God speaks. And throughout the scripture, of course, we can find many places where God spoke to men in dreams. And during that time, he opens the ears of men and he seals their instructions, that he may withdraw man from his purpose and hide pride from man. God deals with us in order that he might change us, change our direction. We decide we're going to do something. We plunge into it, and God will put something, an obstacle in the path to turn us away from a path that maybe is destructive to us. Change our purposes and to hide us from pride, to keep us from being lifted up in pride. He keeps back his soul from the pit. God is actually protecting you from the destruction that awaits. And he is keeping him from perishing by the sword. I happen to believe that God does work in our lives on many occasions when we are totally unconscious of it. I believe that the steps of a righteous man are ordered by the Lord, and he delights in his way. And I do believe that God often keeps us from danger through things that we often look at as irritating. We come out to go someplace, we jump in the car, we're a little late, and we have a difficulty backing up, and we hear this thump, 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 and lo and behold, there's a flat tire. Oh, of all the times to have a flat tire, oh Lord, you know. And so we change the tire, and it takes us 10, 15 minutes, we get the tire changed. But I happen to believe that God is possibly sparing you from some accident on the freeway. Here we are moaning and groaning about, you know, this delay that's forced upon us. But yet, God could be protecting us from something we don't even know. And I've learned to look at interruptions this way. As God sparing me from some kind of pit, from some kind of danger, and that his timing is perfect. Now, that surely changes your attitude towards these kind of disturbances. For when you consider that God may be, in fact, keeping you from some kind of harm or danger, you then don't curse the disturbance, but you bless the Lord for the disturbance. Thank you, Lord, that you're watching over me. Thank you, Lord, that you're protecting me. Thank you, Lord, that you love me and you're taking care of me. And it gives you a total different attitude towards these things that would maybe upset you and get you all angry and, you know, when you arrive, you're just fit to be tied, you know, and everybody's in your way, and you're blasting your horn, and you're angry, and you're up tense, you know, you're tense, and you're uptight, and here all the while, God is just protecting you, and he's got to go through all this guff, because he's saving you from some kind of a danger. So if you look at it, well, listen, God knows, and God's hand is on my life, and God is guiding me, and thank you, Lord, for being so gracious and caring so much and watching over me and keeping me. And so he withdraws man from his purpose. He turns us many times from the path that we are on. He keeps back his soul from the pit, his life from perishing by the sword. He is chastened. Man is also chastened with pain upon his bed and the multitude of his bones with strong pain. God sometimes uses pain for his purposes of instruction in our lives. So that his life abhorreth bread and his soul dainty meat. You can be so sick that you just don't want anything to eat. And man's flesh is consumed away that it cannot be seen. Through the prolonged illness, he becomes like a skeleton. His bones are now sticking out. His flesh is over his bones like a tight drum almost. And he describes really probably Job's condition. His bones that were not seen stick out. A guy's fat, you don't see his bones. And fatness was considered a sign of health. And of course, you see a person whose bones are sticking out, you know they're sick. Yea, his soul draweth near unto the grave, and his life to the destroyers. But God is seeking to get a message across to man through these things. Brings him right down to the grave many times, almost to the point of death. But if there be an angel with him who can interpret for him the things of God, what God is seeking to say, one among a thousand to show unto man his uprightness, then he is gracious unto him and saith, deliver him from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom. So if the man is corrected, someone can point out what God is seeking to say to the man, and the man's path is corrected, he can be saved. He can be ransomed. And he is restored. His flesh shall be fresher than a child's. Job, you know, if you just learn what God is seeking to teach you through this. And I'm going to be the one that's going to teach you what God is trying to teach you, you know. I'm the interpreter for you. I am the angel who is going to help you in this matter. And then his flesh shall be fresher than a child's. He shall return to the days of his youth. You'll be restored again. And he shall pray unto God, and he will be favorable unto him, and he shall see his face with joy, for he will render unto man his righteousness. And so, again, the idea is learn the lessons. God is trying to stop you from something. He's trying to turn your back. Learn what God is seeking to say, and you'll be restored back to health. He looketh upon man, if any say, I have sinned and perverted that which was right, and it profited me not. He will deliver his soul from going into the pit, and his life shall see the light. That is, if you will confess, look, I was wrong, I sinned, but there was no profit in that sin. I wasn't profited by what I did. I cheated, but it only made matters worse. Or I lied, and it just compounded the whole problem. I sinned, and it was not a profit to me. There are people who think that they have profited by their sin. But this man has made the confession. And he said, God will deliver his soul from going into the pit. His life shall see the light. I know that God oftentimes, he says, works with man this way. To bring back his soul from the pit, to be enlightened with the light of the living. Mark well, O Job, and hearken unto me. Hold thy peace and I'll speak. Now, at this point, Job probably started to answer this kid. And he saw that Job was getting ready to respond to him. So he said, wait a minute, keep your mouth shut, let me finish, is basically what he is saying. Mark well, O Job, hearken unto me, hold your peace, let me speak now. You know, you had your turn, let me have my turn, let me speak. And then he probably felt bad for Job being the older man and so he said, now if you do have anything to say, go ahead and answer me, speak, for I desire to justify you. And so, first of all, he told Job, just be quiet, wait, let me speak. And then he felt better about the thing, or felt wiser about it. He said, well, if you have anything to say, go ahead. But I'm really wanting to get the answers for you. And if not, if you're not going to speak, and probably he gave Job, he probably was quiet for a minute. Job probably just shrugged it off. And so he said, okay, if not, then listen to me, hold your peace, and I'm going to teach you wisdom. This kid, he's pretty brash. So Elihu now turns from addressing Job and addresses the friends of Job. And he said, hear my words, O ye wise men. give ear unto me, you that have knowledge. For the ear trieth words as the mouth tasteth meat. Interesting kind of a thought. As your mouth is able to taste and discern the various tastes and enjoy some and find some rather sour and some bitter, so the ear, there are words that are sweet, there are words that are bitter, and so the sensory perceptions that we have, both from the mouth and from the ear acts in a similar kind of a way in that it weighs the words that are said, as the mouth tastes the meat and the ears the words. Let us choose to us judgment. Let us know among ourselves what is good. For Job has said, I am righteous, and God takes away my judgment. That's what Job has said. Should I lie against my right? Job said this. He said, you guys are wanting me to confess my sin. And I maintain that I am innocent, and if I confess to a guilt in this, I wouldn't be telling the truth. So should I lie against my right? Do you want me to lie and say that I'm wrong? Have you ever been in that? I have been in that position when Pearson is insisting that, you know, you're not telling them the truth. And I've said this sometimes. I said, hey, you want me to lie? Would you feel better if I just lie about it and tell you, yeah, that's what I was thinking? Does that make you feel better? And so Job pretty much said, you know, if should I lie against what is right? Job said, my wound is incurable without transgression. I've been wounded incurably, and yet I'm not guilty of the transgression. And so these are the things that Job had been maintaining: his righteousness, that God had taken away his judgment, that he, if he confessed to some guilt, he would be lying against the truth, that his wound is incurable. And he said, what man is like Job who drinks up the scorning like water? I mean, you guys have been scorning this guy, and he's just been drinking it down like water. I mean, you haven't been able to, you know, affect him. Who is like Job? Which goeth in company with the workers of iniquity and walks with wicked men. For he said, it profits a man nothing that he should delight himself with God. Job really didn't say that, but this is an inference from the things that Job did say. This is something, though, that the psalmist did say in Psalm 73, as he was trying to understand why the ungodly prospered and he was suffering when he sought to follow after God. He said, I have cleansed my hands in innocency. I have washed my hands in innocency. It doesn't pay to try and serve God. And this is what he is accusing Job of saying. It profits a man nothing that he should delight himself in God. Job didn't say that, and of course that is not true. There is tremendous profit in delighting yourself in the Lord. Delight yourself also in the Lord. He will give you the desires of your heart. Therefore, he said, hearken unto me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God that he should do wickedness, and from the Almighty that he should commit iniquity. For the work of a man shall he render unto him, and cause every man to find according to his ways. God gives to a man that which he deserves. As a man sows, that shall he also reap. Yea, surely God will not do wickedly, neither will the Almighty pervert judgment. Abraham said, shall not the Lord of the earth be just? And Elihu is making the same kind of a claim, which is correct. God is absolutely fair. He will not pervert judgment. Who hath given him a charge over the earth? Or who hath disposed the whole world? If he set his heart upon man, if he gathers unto himself his spirit and his breath, all flesh shall perish together, and man shall turn again into dust. All God would have to do is just withdraw from man, and it would be over. God formed man out of the dust of the earth, and God breathed into man. And man became a living soul, the breath of God. When Belshazzar had this great feast for 1,000 of his lords, in the celebrating of the great strength of the city of Babylon, and was drunk, but for entertainment, ordered that the servants go to the treasury of Babylon and get the gold and the silver vessels that his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had taken out of the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, that he and his mistresses might drink their wine out of these sanctified vessels from the house of God. While they were drinking from these consecrated vessels that had once been in the temple and service of God, and they were praising the gods of gold and silver, suddenly there came a hand writing on the plaster of the wall words that they did not understand. And when they saw this hand writing there on the plaster of the wall, his knees, it says, began to smite against each other. He was frightened, terrified. And he called for his wise men to interpret for him what that says. Strange words, meeny, meeny, tekel, upharsin. What does it mean? None of them were able to help him, or were unwilling to help him, perhaps, because it was a judgment against him, and it could be that they were fearful. And so the queen mother came in and said, during the reign of your grandfather Nebuchadnezzar, there was a Jewish young man who was very skilled in interpreting visions and dreams and all, and your grandfather used him, and he can surely tell you what it says. And so they called Daniel into this feast where this whole scene of debauchery was taking place. And Daniel, before he interpreted the writing for him, said unto him, Belshazzar, when your grandfather was reigning over the kingdom, he was lifted up in pride. And God dealt with that and allowed him a period of insanity that he might know that God rules. And he made proclamations concerning God. But you have praised the gods of gold and silver, and the God in whose hand your very breath is, you have not glorified. God actually controls your breath. You depend upon God for your breath. Now, Elihu is saying much the same thing. If God would just withdraw his breath from man, we'd all go back to the dust. It would be snuff city for all of us. Be over. All God would have to do is just withdraw our breath. Now, it is interesting that man has voluntary and involuntary muscles. The voluntary muscles are attached to the skeleton and are controlled by the conscious thought of the brain. The involuntary muscles are not attached to the skeleton of the body and are not controlled by conscious thoughts from the brain. Your involuntary muscles are your heart and your lungs. Those muscles upon which your life depends, God did not leave them in your control. He knew better. You would get thoughtless and it would be over. The God in whose hand your very breath is, you have not glorified. And so Elihu speaks here about if God would just withdraw his spirit and his breath, all flesh would perish together and man would turn again into dust. The spirit of man is an interesting thing. The consciousness of man. When the brain ceases to function, when the consciousness of man goes, man is considered dead, and the body begins to deteriorate. Interesting. What causes the consciousness to remain? What is it that releases? What is it that triggers the release of the consciousness? What is death? We know that we can keep a body alive with life support systems for a period of time. Keep pumping the oxygen in. The heart will continue to flutter. And a body can be kept going, the functions of the body be kept going artificially for a period of time. And this often takes place when a person is in the hospital and has gone into a coma and is in perhaps a terminal condition. They will connect up the life support system. They will keep the oxygen going into the body. They'll keep monitoring the heart flutters or heart action. But they also connect the EEG probes. And they watch the brainwave activity on this little monitor. Well, actually, it's a little graph, and this little needle bounces on that graph, indicating that there is brainwave activity. But then when the brain ceases, the line goes flat. What causes the brain to cease? What's happened? When that happens, the body then begins to deteriorate. Death. When God withdraws his spirit or his breath, man goes back to dust. Our lives are dependent upon God. God sustains our lives. The very fact that we are alive today is due to the fact that God has sustained us. The God in whose hand your very breath is. Isn't that interesting that many times men use that very breath to curse God who is sustaining them and giving them the breath? What a tragedy. When God gives you that very breath that is sustaining you, that a person would use that breath to curse God. If God should withdraw his spirit, his breath, we'd perish together. We would turn again to dust. Now he's saying to these fellows, if you guys have understanding, listen to this. Hearken to the voice of my words. Shall even he that hateth right govern? And will you condemn him that is most just? Job, he said, is condemning God, saying that God isn't fair. But he said, is it fit to say to a king that you are wicked and to princes you are ungodly? I mean, would you dare say that to the king? You're a wicked man. If you wouldn't say that to a king or a prince, how much less to him that does not even accept the persons of princes, nor regards the rich more than the poor? God is so far above man that God doesn't accept the rich more than the poor or the persons of princes. You are just as important to God as the Pope, as the President, as Mikhail Gorbachev. In God's eyes, you're just as important to God as anyone else. But lest you be puffed up, that native in New Guinea dancing nude around the fire in the full moon is just as important to God as you are. God doesn't respect a person's position in life. He's high above it. He doesn't regard the rich more than the poor. These are characteristics of man in giving deference to the rich. But not so with God. For they are all the work of his hands. God sees us all alike. And really, the Lord speaks out against us making these distinctions ourselves. The Lord would have us to treat all men equally, to look upon all men equally, and not to look down on any man. Who am I that I should look down on someone else? To think that I am in any wise superior to someone else? God does not appreciate that kind of attitude from people. It seems that so often we get so important in our own estimation. And there is that tendency of man to think of himself more highly than he ought and then to begin to look down upon others. And God help us. They are all the work of his hands, and in a moment shall they die, and the people shall be troubled at midnight and pass away, and the mighty shall be taken away without hand. Without the stroke of a man's hand against him, God takes the life of a person. For his eyes are upon the ways of man, and he sees his goings. There is no darkness nor shadow of death where the workers of iniquity may hide themselves. You can't hide from God. People often are trying to hide their deeds. They live in darkness. They go out at night to cover their deeds. But it says, hey, there is no darkness where you can hide from him. For he will not lay upon man more than what is right. God will be fair, that he should enter into judgment with God. He can break and shall break in pieces the mighty men without number and set others in their stead. God can bring down the great and raise up people to, you know, the earth goes on. None of you are indispensable. The great die, the world continues. Therefore he knows their works, he overturns them in the night so that they are destroyed. He strikes them as wicked men in the open sight of others, because they have turned their backs from him and would not consider any of his ways. so that they cause the cry of the poor to come unto him, and he hears the cry of the afflicted. Those that have used their position of wealth or power to subjugate others under them, to afflict others, God listens to the cry of the afflicted. When he gives quietness, who then can make trouble? And when he hides his face, who then can behold him? Whether it be done against a nation or against an individual person. That the people, or that the hypocrite reign not, lest the people be ensnared. Surely it is necessary to be said unto God, I have borne chastisement, I will not offend anymore. God, I've learned my lessons, I won't offend anymore. I've received the chastisement. That which I see not, teach thou me. Be open to listen and to be instructed by God. And if I have done iniquity, I will do it no more. Should it be according to thy mind, he will recompense it whether thou refuse or whether thou choose, and not I. Therefore, speak what thou knowest. And then he said, let the men of understanding tell me, and let the wise men hearken unto me. Job hath spoken without knowledge. His words were without wisdom. My desire is that Job may be tried unto the end because of his answers for wicked men. I just want God to really put the screws on this guy till he cries uncle. I mean, he has... not really learn what God is trying to teach him. He's accusing God of not being fair with him. And he refuses to learn the things that God is endeavoring to show him. For he has added to his sin this rebellion. For he claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. So, I really want to see God really put this guy through it. The clapping of his hands, it's fascinating to watch the people of the Middle East as they are talking and dealing with each other. You can't understand what they're saying, and sometimes I'm sort of glad. But I mean, they say it with... standing there, really, many times, I thought that I stood there because I was sure I was going to observe a murder. They would be yelling at each other, screaming at each other, waving their hands. And they just really get just screaming at each other. And you're sure that, in a moment, the guy's going to reach in his cloak and pull out a dagger, and it's all over, And you're just going to watch the guy get slain right there before you. Fascinating to watch them as they argue with each other, and as they and this was the kind of thing. Don't just read this book of Job and think of just casual intellectual kind of these guys are yelling at each other, they're screaming at each other, they're clapping their hands, they're waving their fist, and they're giving, they're really into it with each other. And this is a real drama that's going on here between Job and his friends. And you can't just see it as, kickback conversation city. This is a real go-round that these guys are in. And so he's angry with Job because of Job's vehement kind of defense for himself. And accusations that somehow God isn't fair in his treatment of him. That he doesn't deserve these things that he is experiencing. And so Elihu adds this as, not only is Job guilty of speaking against God, words without wisdom or knowledge, but now he's added to the whole thing his rebellion. As he's clapped his hands and multiplied his words against God. Elihu continues his discourse through chapter 37. And next week we will go ahead and follow out the end of the argument of Elihu. And then we get into one of the most fascinating sections of the book. Man has said his piece. Man has guessed at God and the ways of God. But in chapter 38, God finally speaks out and shows the folly of all of man's wisdom and reasoning. And God deals with the issues. And we'll have a great time as we get into chapter 38. I can hardly wait. May the Lord be with you, give you a good week. May His love just fill your heart until you just overflow. In fact, may your heart sort of be like that wineskin that Elihu was talking about, just pressured with God's love so great that you feel you're going to pop. May you just experience the consciousness of God's presence as He leads and guides you in His path. May it be just a week of spiritual growth, drawing closer to God as we draw closer to Christmas and we think again of God's great love in giving His Son to be the Redeemer, to save us from our sins. In Jesus' name.